I'm Paige Albiniak, editorial director at ProMax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. During quarantine, one thing everyone has assumed is that everyone is watching lots of TV. And if you look at the data, that is true. But what is not true is that everyone is up to their eyeballs in new streaming services. Unfortunately, the increasingly challenging financial circumstances brought on by the pandemic means that although people have more time, they have less money, and thus they are choosing to pay for less TV. Still, there are many other interesting trends that are emerging from this time. And in this episode, Ben Carlson, Senior Vice President of Streaming and Platforms at MarketCast, presents research that reveals viewer streaming TV usage patterns during the pandemic. There are lots of useful nuggets in here, so pay attention. At the end, ProMax CEO Steve Kazanjian jumps in to conduct some Q&A before wrapping it all up. Okay, take it away, Ben.
Thank you, and very excited to be here. And we're going to be talking about several different things today. We're going to be looking through subscription trends. So we're going to be looking at how subscription to streaming services in the US has changed from last fall all the way through to the kind of current COVID quarantine period. We're going to be looking at trends in the streaming platforms themselves. So what are the things that, which services are rising, which ones are a bit challenged, and what does that mean for the major streaming platforms that are yet to launch this year? We're going to be looking at content trends. What are the things that people are watching? Why are they watching them? And what does it mean for both content creation as well as content marketing? And then finally, we're going to start to talk about the future a little bit. What does all of this mean moving forward, and how should we think about it? I am from MarketCast. MarketCast is a research firm that fuels fandom for brand, sport, and entertainment platforms globally. A lot of the research and data that we're going to be sharing today comes from our MarketCast streaming tracker. Our streaming tracker has a holistic tracking framework. It uses social media data. We pull in over 5 million organic social posts every week around streaming. And then weekly survey data. So every week we talk to 1,000 subscribers in the US to at least one streaming service. And we ask them a whole bunch of different questions. We're focused on tracking all the major streaming platforms in the US. And in terms of content, this is actually one of the trickier elements, is how to keep up on everything, just because, as I'm sure everyone is aware, just at home trying to watch, figure out what to watch on streaming services, there's just so much stuff. So we track over 700 original and library series that we track and then evaluate to create our top 150 that appears in every report. And we have a team dedicated to that, because unlike theatrical feature films or even major broadcast and cable series, what comes to streaming and how quickly it comes into play is a little harder to track. So we'll start with subscription and really focusing in on a lot of the questions that we ask in our survey every week. And one of the things we always ask is, how many streaming video subscriptions do you have? How many paid streaming video subscriptions? We had, when we started this in October, we had pretty quick upward trajectory into December. And that tracks as you think about Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus starting in that window of time, leveled off in January, started to go back up in February. And then we've seen it be flat through March and April. So even as the streaming behavior has increased during the COVID quarantine period, the number of self-reported paid subscriptions has been flat. People haven't been adding new subscriptions. Kind of companion question to that is when we ask, how much are you spending on streaming video subscriptions? And again, we see something that looks very similar to the number of streaming services that people have. We see a quick upward trajectory through the fourth quarter of last year, flattened in January, and then another rise in February and March. But we see that actually it's down slightly in April, the first month that we've been tracking it here, where the amount of self-reported spend on streaming services is down, which is interesting when you think about just how important streaming services are to everyone's entertainment right now. People can't go out to the movie theater, and yet the spend is down. We've always asked, if people are open to subscribing to additional streaming services if something appeals to them. So this is not looking at just, are you open to eventually doing it? It's at, if something appeals to you, are you open to subscribing to something new? And we see something interesting happen here. We see a general downward trend. We see that we had two spikes. Those spikes were in November and in February. And in November, Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus launched. And so people were indicated that they were more open during that time. In February, HBO Max and Peacock and Quibi all launched their marketing campaigns. And so all of a sudden, when people had something in front of them, we saw an increase in these numbers. But that downward trajectory is a bit concerning. Probably of even more concern is this question. How much more do you anticipate spending on streaming video subscriptions in the future? No one wants to spend more, but I think everyone understood that there was, as new things would come into the marketplace, and as more choices would come in, people would be spending more money. And we saw it mostly flat with a slight upward movement all the way through until, of course, we hit April. And this is the first time we've seen a significant drop off in the amount of future spend that consumers anticipate spending on streaming services. And this gets really concerning when you think about how in May, June, July, we're going to be seeing the launch of these major new streaming platforms in HBO Max and Peacock. So overall, just in terms of subscription, even though we've probably all been wearing out the subscription services we have today and watching more than we've ever had the opportunity to before, that's not turning into increased subscriptions, increased spend, or increased anticipated future spend in the space. So now we'll take a quick look at the platform trends and what's happening on every individual streaming service. And we'll start with one of my favorite ones, and I'll set this up and describe it because it's a little hard to understand at first glance. So for every streaming service, we ask, is if you are a subscriber, so in this case, if you are a subscriber to Netflix, is Netflix your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, or other when you turn on the TV and try to find something to watch? And what we found is Netflix is the first choice to watch streaming content for 70% of their own subscribers. So 70% of the people who subscribe to Netflix, it's the first place that they go to watch something. It's in the top three for 98% of Netflix subscribers. So they have not just a tremendous subscriber base, that subscriber base uses the service and they use it regularly. That may seem, maybe it's a bit, well, of course, if you're subscribing, it should be something you turn to. But when we compare it to the other streaming platforms, you can see just how dominant Netflix is in that first choice position. So they are the first choice for 70% of their own subscribers. Hulu, for their own subscribers, not the entire universe, but just for Hulu subscribers, they're the first choice 28% of the time. And then you can see so on and so forth down the line. There's a 42 percentage point difference between Netflix as first choice among their own subscribers and second place in Hulu at 28%. And there's only 19 percentage points separating Hulu at 28% from Apple TV Plus at 9%. So there's just a tremendous dominant position that Netflix has as that first place that people go to. And when we look at it from the top three perspective, as we mentioned before, Netflix is 98% top three choice among their own subscribers. Now we can see here, this is where it really does start to bunch up. There's only 22% spread between Netflix and then Disney Plus at 76%. And then a pretty significant jump down to Apple TV Plus. Apple TV Plus subscribers tend to be more tech-oriented, tech-forward, early adopters. So it stands to reason that they have more streaming services, so there's just a larger percentage of their subscribers that would have more than three choices. We always ask about value for money. Your subscription that you're paying money for, do you feel like it's good value for the money? And we ask people to rank that on a 0 to 100 scale, 100 being exceptional, 0 being absolutely awful. And we see, for the most part, it was a pretty tight connection there in the 60s to 80s for all the major platforms. But we see in April, all the streaming services except Netflix ticked down. Again, very interesting when we think about the fact that the month of April, we've relied on streaming for our entertainment in our homes, more so than any other time in the short history of streaming. It had to serve as the replacement for our movie going, our sports consumption, all the other things that we usually do with our free time. And yet, even at this time, when streaming was incredibly vital and important for consumers, with the exception of Netflix, the value for the money went down. It's very interesting because it's tied to something a little unexpected, that notion of value. As we look across all of the other data parameters, what we saw was that value was tied most closely to the frequency of new original TV releases. So as the value went down, it went down in the same relation to the frequency of TV releases, which is not something we'd seen previously. We'd seen things around quality or user experience have more of an impact, but it really was about frequency. And so now I want to talk about why I think that is. And one of the ways I've thought about streaming is that it's part of our personal entertainment portfolio. And in our personal entertainment portfolio, there's two things that we manage and we spend. And that's time and it's money. And previously, people were a bit time starved and maybe they had enough money to continue to add subscriptions. But what we're seeing right now in the time of COVID quarantine is the amount of time we have go up and the amount of money that we want to spend on this go down. And so all of a sudden, it's recalibrated that notion of value and what's important to us in streaming decision making. So a couple of things that having more time and less money mean. One, binge releases are worth more than episodic releases. So something that releases all at once, like an Ozark season 3, has more value in the mind of the audience than something like Defending Jacob on Apple TV Plus, which had a 3-episode release and then a weekly cadence to follow. All of a sudden, consumers sitting at home, they've got time. Time is not the scarce resource that it was before. And so they want to be able to watch at their own pace and see everything on their own time. This is something that's very different from some of the trends that we were seeing at the end of last year. The end of last year, we were seeing things like The Morning Show and The Mandalorian dominate the cultural conversation over a longer period of time because they were releasing episodically. Versus what had previously been happening with binge releases is that they would come out, they would have a spike in viewership and in social conversation over the course of a weekend, or if they're lucky, maybe a week or two, and then they would die off. Whereas those signature shows like The Mandalorian continued to be talked about, continued to drive viewership week over week, and people weren't upset with that. People liked the rhythms and it reminded them of other entertainment that they've enjoyed on television, things like Game of Thrones on HBO, where you get used to that weekly cadence. But here, you know, you can see this back and forth on Twitter around the availability of Little Fires Everywhere on Hulu and the fact that it wasn't released in a binge model. And as this person responds at the end, now is not the time for episodic release schedules, people. It's time for the binge. So that is one significant change that we've seen. And it's something that I know at the end of last year and even into the beginning of this year, I talked a lot about the power of episodic releases for streaming services and how audiences were not annoyed or put off by it. And it allowed for a longer hit for these major pieces of content. But we're seeing the present circumstance, again, more time, less money, really change the equation there. Something else that it's changed is that available choices now have far more weight than curated quality. So if we think about just Netflix releases, they released Too Hot to Handle, kind of a fun, trashy reality show, The Innocence Files, a docuseries that gets into true crime, Outer Banks, a teen drama, Cooked with Cannabis, a weed-focused cooking show, a sitcom from the makers of Blackish, and a major action movie in Extraction starring Chris Hemsworth, All of these were released on Netflix between April 15th and April 24th. So you're talking about an amazing range of programming choices, various levels of quality, and this isn't even all that was offered. Netflix had way more that they put out into the marketplace. But what we're seeing there is that idea of choice and availability having more of an impact on how people are thinking about the value for their subscription dollar and where they turn to for their subscription streaming programming. So it's a good time to then segue into overall what this means from a content perspective and the trends that we're seeing around content. Going back to our three waves of our MarketCast streaming tracker prior to the quarantine period and looking at what came into the top of our charts for engagement during that time, both in terms of original series and library series, we saw a show like Atlanta debut in the series as FX's library of shows landed on Hulu. We saw Hunters, an Amazon original on Prime Video, a lot of promotional push behind it. We saw Lost enter the charts as people were rediscovering it and watching it either again or for the first time. And we saw the second season of Altered Carbon. So as we think about these kinds of shows that made up that top engagement series, the new entries to the top engagement series during that 6-week window of time, some themes start to emerge. These shows were smart, they were new, they were challenging. Even something like Atlanta, even though it's been on FX for a time, it was new to streaming. It was something that people were looking to and watching. Now, if we look at the same metric, what is new to our top engagement series for the window from March 14th to April 24th, so the three waves that we did during quarantine, some of those new series included Community, Little Fires Everywhere, That 70s Show, and On My Block from Netflix. And so if we start to think about the bigger trends of what these series represent, we saw things that were more fun, things that were familiar. Even if it was a new series like Little Fires Everywhere, there's great familiarity with the cast and Reese and Carrie as two beloved stars. And there was just a notion of just overall more easy watching in the content that people were seeking out and spending time with. So overall, in March and April, some of the series that launched and performed very, very well included Ozark Season 3 was watched a lot. It was talked about a lot. Little Fires Everywhere, as I mentioned. And then I couldn't get away with not mentioning Joe Exotic and Tiger King. So these series all debuted during this window of time and performed very well. Some of the series that launched in that same window and didn't perform quite as well include Devs, Amazing Stories, and Tales from the Loop. And it's interesting as we think about these series all together, and again, there are exceptions to every rule and to every trend, but we start to think about these and these series are smart, they're challenging, they're new, they're conceptual, even the key art. As the key art on the other slide of the well-performing shows showed a lot of faces, recognizable faces. Here we see very arresting key art of a giant statue of a little girl looming over a forest. Tremendously powerful conceptual image, but these series didn't connect with audiences in the same way. And all of these challenging shows just felt like they were potentially could have broken through and found greater success with audiences in a pre-quarantine time, but now audiences are looking for things just a little bit different, not quite as challenging or sad. We talked about familiarity, and that really is one of the big trends. So as we look across both original series as well as library series, we see things like Law & Order Special Victims Unit going up on our rankings. We see Ozark Season 3, as we talked about. We see Community. We see audiences going back to shows that are old friends. But that's not the only connection to familiarity. We also see Little Fires Everywhere, The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus going up. We see Mrs. America, FX on Hulu, doing quite well. And these actors are old friends too. We want to go and spend time with them. And that's an element of familiarity that we see as a content positive currently. One of the other big content trends is this notion of catch-up viewing. When we look across all the platforms, oftentimes their biggest, most signature series are still performing, and especially during this March-April window, they're performing even better. So on Prime Video, it's The Boys. On Hulu, it's The Handmaid's Tale. Stranger Things on Netflix. The Mandalorian on Disney Plus, and The Morning Show on Apple TV Plus. So the biggest shows on these platforms are still big, even if they aren't new. We still see people coming to Stranger Things, even though the last series, the last new season of the series was released last July. People are coming back to it either to rewatch it because they're mega fans, or because they finally have time to go and watch these series that they've heard so much about. I wanted to talk also a little bit about a few unlikely hits and a few case studies. One is Kingdom on Netflix. Kingdom is a series from South Korea. And in April, it ranked number one in evangelism on our streaming tracker. It had more social recommendations than Sex Education, Tales from the Loop, or Little Fires Everywhere, which was shocking for a non-English language series. And there were big fans like Patton Oswalt who took to social to recommend this as, if you've watched everything that you want to watch, here's something new that does feel a little fresh. But even it was positioned in very familiar ways. People talked about Kingdom as having the action and pace of a Walking Dead, but the scope and scale of a Game of Thrones, and audiences took to that. One of the other interesting trends that we're seeing are rewatches, and Breaking Bad is one that has been talked about a lot. And there was a new season of Better Call Saul, increased amount of free time. And so we saw rewatches of Breaking Bad really spike. But what's interesting and a bit different is that we've seen this new fan infrastructure rise up to support it. So here's an example of a Twitter account and a group that actually started by doing Lost rewatch podcasts, but now they're doing Breaking Bad. And if you donate to that group, you get access to a private Slack channel, and you can actually watch and talk with the people as they're watching it in real time on Slack. And as you can see there, they call it Stream Together, Watch Alone. This is not a unique behavior to Breaking Bad. We've seen podcasts like Mr. Rewatch, which looks at Mr. Robot, come up. We've seen the Community Rewatch podcast, Twin Peaks Rewatch, Parks and Rewatch. Bill Simmons, The Ringer Podcast Network, has one for The Wire called Way Down in the Hole. Even Talking Sopranos, where we actually have stars of the show who have launched a podcast to talk about the series and get into specifics in the episodes. So this idea of a fan infrastructure and connection, community, conversation, even for something that's not new, we're seeing a real rise in that currently. And then the last kind of digging deeper I wanted to get into is this notion of nostalgia-fueled comfort food. Disney Plus has a tremendous catalog. They've got all of Marvel, Star Wars, everything on there. But one of the things that we're seeing have the biggest impact from their library are these 2000s Disney Channel original series. We're seeing The Suite Life, Wizards of Waverly Place, That's So Raven, all of those being talked about and rewatched, and audiences, especially millennial audiences, turning to those during this time. And it's even being picked up and documented in digital and mainstream media. So as we think about some of the bigger takeaways from all of this, the last 2 months have really changed the balance of time and money in everyone's personal entertainment portfolio. With the increase of time and decrease in money, consumers are thinking differently about value. They're now valuing quantity, choice, and immediacy more than they did previously. And as we think about what that means for future impact, even in a post-quarantine world, we believe that a recessionary environment and high unemployment can continue this trend in value perception. So a lot of the things that we're seeing taking hold right now are going to have a longer lasting impact. We believe that there's a tremendous value in quote unquote big shows. Series is very, just Breaking Bad and That's So Raven aren't just being watched. They're inspiring active fan participation. So the value in these series are going up. And the signature shows for the major streaming services are still being watched, even though they are not new releases. So as we think into the future, we have HBO Max and Peacock launching, and they're going to have major library titles. If you've seen any of the HBO Max marketing, they're stringing together The Sopranos, Friends, and Big Bang Theory. So that idea of these big shows being available is going to continue as a trend. And we know that all the streaming services are going to be searching for their next big original series once production can start again. And then finally, and the big takeaways, familiarity and connection are really important right now. Well-known shows, famous stars, and comfort rewatches are major drivers of viewership over the last 2 months. Shows that are brand new without on-ramps of familiarity, especially if they are challenging or overly intellectual, are having a hard time breaking through with audiences. And so as we think into the future, it may not be a long-term trend, but streaming creators and marketers should really emphasize currently what makes a series familiar versus what makes it different, which is pretty unique in this time. So that is the end of the presentation, but I do think we have a little bit of time for a Q&A.
That was amazing. So I love that connection point from, thank you for that, Ben, by the way. I always love hearing you present. So that connection between more time, less money, and how that flipped, how that tied into the fun, familiar, and easy, if you will. But what's interesting is that from a marketing, or putting our brand marketer hats on, the idea around that familiarity and connection of the content that people like and how these new distribution, or I would say marketing channels are rising, who would have thought that Slack would have been a really effective channel? That's something that, you know, we talk about these COVID moments that we're in right now, and what are some of the new innovative marketing ideas that come out of it? That's probably one of the most interesting I've seen so far. And it reinforces the familiarity and why you want that familiarity. And with people you don't even know, I think that's just, it's a really fascinating way of connecting. We have a handful of questions, but it's so funny because I had this on my list as well. John Root texted at this exact same time. What's Quibi doing? What's going on with that? How's it been responding? I just heard it's a 90 days free, which is kind of unheard of, if I'm right about that.
Yeah, and according to what we're seeing in our metrics, and we're really focused on the content side of it, it's probably a bit quieter. I know it's quieter than the launches of Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus were, which is not necessarily surprising. I think I'm most interested in what content is kind of rising to the top. And it ties into what we've seen overall. The content that has more familiarity, something like a Punk'd that people know from MTV and now has Chance the Rapper as a part of it, or the new series with Anna Kendrick playing a very Anna Kendrick role. Those things are the people that people are that's the content on Quibi that people are responding to more so than I think some of their more daring new content. So that's, I think, the biggest takeaway that we've seen on it so far.
So you mentioned this in your presentation, this idea that the first 30 days were more escapism, if you will, to a certain extent, and now we're in this familiarity. What are the next? Do you have any idea what those next 30 days look like?
I mean, I think it's about how much content is left to be released. You know, I think everyone had great plans for what the next big series were going to be, when new seasons were going to drop. Some of that's in the can. Netflix seemingly has an unending amount of content that they're releasing like every week. But I think some of the new stuff is going to be just what's available. But I think for everyone in the marketing space to think about is, regardless of what the show is, are there things that can make it more relevant and more palatable to audiences today? So again, I go back to that notion of, if it's a choice between marketing something in a way that feels comfortable and familiar, and look, that's something that I tend to like, the things that are new, unique, different, never seen before. But right now, talking about the ways that these series are familiar and comfortable does seem to be what audiences are gravitating to.
Okay, so then switching over from a streaming standpoint, what are the specific things that streaming providers should be doing differently right now?
I think one is thinking about all of those on-ramps of familiarity, going through all that content and figuring out, okay, Is it the theme? Is it the actors? What is it? I'm also really intrigued by this notion of, we've seen this fan infrastructure around community and conversation come up very organically, and we, you know, the Slack and the podcasts, and how do we watch these things together? I think that there's a really unique opportunity to build that fan infrastructure, even if it's not naturally occurring. So, I mean, I think that's one thing that streamers should think about is what's out there organically that I can amplify and build off of, or if there isn't something, is there something I should do? If there isn't a podcast that's going through my series, should I talk to passionate fans or stars of the show and launch one?
I think that's really interesting. So the question obviously is, you know, a lot of the people who are listening right now aren't necessarily at an OTT. They're at, you know, whether it's a local station, it's broadcast, it's cable, et cetera. Do you see these behaviors connect in on into those channels as well? Or is this unique to the OTT world?
It's a great question. I think that some things we're seeing in commonality. So that the money pressure, as we ask people about things like cable and satellite subscriptions, we're seeing the exact same trends there that we are with streaming service subscriptions. So I think in a macro sense, there's a lot of the same drivers of time and money that are putting the same pressures on. I think what is a bit unique about streaming is that it's focused almost exclusively on entertainment. It's just entertaining content, whereas broadcast, cable, local television, news and sports are such a big part of it. And sports just aren't available currently. And news is something where we're seeing, you know, increased consumption of it, but maybe not increased love of it. So I think that's the one kind of unique for more traditional broadcasters versus the OTT space is how do I juggle the news and sports at the same time I'm trying to deliver an entertainment package.
And then do you see switching over this relationship, and this question is from Sheena, this relationship between subscription acquisition, you know, attrition and unemployment, right? So have you been able to track that, and where is that going? And given the fact that unemployment is, I think we all know, is we're still going to see an uptick in it over the next 30 days to 60 days, absolutely. What does that mean with, you can call it, say, 8, you can say 9, you know, massive OTTs that are online or will be online. How do those relationships work with each other?
People are going to start to make choices. I think people are going to be more budget conscious. They're going to know the amount of money that's flowing out the door to subscriptions in a way that they hadn't thought about it previously. And so there's going to be trade-offs. You're going to see some people say, I don't need the big cable package anymore because I have streaming that can fit the bill for this stuff. Others will say, I signed up for all of these streaming services because I was curious and I heard about one show over here or one show over there. We're going to see, I think, more churn. And that's just going to pick up when new entrants like HBO Max and Peacock enter the field. They start their marketing. They have series that people are going to want. Before, I think as we were in last year, we saw an ever-expanding pool for streaming subscriptions. And I would put cable and satellite packages into that mix as well. But now we're going to see trade-offs and we're going to move to more of a position of churn.
I was just talking to someone else about this, about, you know, the decrease, an obvious decrease in whether it's e-commerce spending or just Main Street spending, and that money being moved over into, you know, OTT and subscription-based spending. So, you know, there's also two camps. One, will those subscriptions remain captive as long as people are sequestered in place? We know Los Angeles, we're opening up to some extent tomorrow. So I'm wondering, you know, there'll be interesting to see if there's a correlation there.
Right. Which could even put increased pressure on the amount of money you're spending on streaming services. Because if we already saw a downturn in the month of April, when there was really no other place to spend your entertainment dollar.
Absolutely. What does that mean? Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so this question from Richard. Richard, Promax equals promotion of content. Fun fact, Promax, actually learned this about 5 years ago when I took this role, which I never knew as a member, promotion and marketing executives. That's what it stands for. Fun fact, you learn something new every day. the more you know. Okay, so ProMax promotion of content, please emphasize how shows, subscriptions are really promoted today. How are these streaming companies getting the word out? What is the media breakdown? It's a good question. You know, I look at it in a lot of ways, like out of home, right, versus in home, and how those things tie together.
The streaming services, they have one kind of built-in advantage in that they actually have their own platform. So as you've seen, Netflix introduced things like the top 10. They're really in control about what shows they're putting in front of you. So they don't need to make you aware of something to remind you to come back on Thursday at 9 p.m. to watch it. Right. You fire it up and it's right in front of your face. So, I mean, I think that's kind of the not so secret weapon that all the streamers have. The other thing is social media, the earned media reach of something like Tiger King. They didn't need to buy traditional television spots to let the world know about Tiger King. It was something that took off online. You read about it. You saw all the memes. It became news. It was one of those things that was much more organic in nature. But that, to a smaller extent, is happening for a lot of these series where people are discovering them through social and digital media.
Absolutely. So from Eric, okay, if consumers have more time and less money, do you predict this environment will be a boon for AVOD services like Peacock? I guess based on price versus, let's say, HBO Max in that case, right?
It's a great question. And I think it's what is greater, your annoyance with ads after you get to live without them. And get conditioned as a consumer of streaming content to not have to deal with them? Yeah. Or is it the idea that I can't spend any more money on this, so I'm going to pay either a little less or nothing at all for an AVOD? I do think that what AVOD opens up in terms of addressable advertising, in terms of new advertising opportunities for the ad sales side of the ledger is fascinating. And I think that there's going to be a lot of great creativity and experimentation there. I would think that AVOD is going to have its moment here as a result of those pressures, but I don't know if we yet know how people feel about going back to spot pods.
Anecdotally, looking at my 12-year-old and 15-year-old daughters and then them watching the commercials, you know, the horror of horrors, like, what is this? You know what I mean? Right. Why is the same commercial playing every single break? Okay, on to the next. We have time for a couple more. Very good insights. This is from James. Very good insights. Thank you, Ben. I have Netflix and never heard of Too Hot to Handle, Cooked with Cannabis, and Black AF. I understand how the service captures and promotes certain titles to me, but why do we rarely see out-of-home advertising? Promos need to be seen.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, Netflix bought an out-of-home company in Los Angeles a year or two ago. So, I mean, if you're in the greater LA area, you see a ton of billboards promoting their new series, but a lot of their shows, it is relegated to the platform or through earned media on social and in digital.
Okay, so from Carlos, is there a specific audience group that is consuming more video streaming? This is a great question. Is there a specific audience group that is consuming more video streaming on these platforms? Any recommendation or insights on how to reach out to these key audiences? So what do you see from a demographic standpoint?
It is a great question. And we're seeing kind of the rising tide lifting all demos. So we're seeing everyone increase. One of the next turns that we're doing on our side in our research is that kind of analysis to try to understand by genre, by content, by platform, what are those audience mixes and how are they changing? Because we have seen in kind of our first cut of the data that it's different audiences driving the different series, but that's something we're getting more and more into. And our clients are wanting to learn that as well. So we're diving deeper for sure into the audience mix.
We only have a couple more minutes left, and I know there's a ton more questions. So I know everyone can reach out to you directly and all your information was on there if they wanted to connect with you. But I always love leaving with this question, which is, you know, we talk a lot about over the last 2 months of how everything's changed, all the struggles that we have to go through, how we're shooting shows out of our living room, you know, Zoom meetings over and over again. For you and your business, what do you think has changed for the better and will it stick?
For us in the research and strategy part of the field, I think one thing that is kind of liberating is that geography and place has kind of fallen away. It doesn't matter. I saw at the beginning, somebody piped in that they were from Denver, and I'm actually here in Indianapolis, and we've got part of our team in LA and New York and London.
Right, right.
And we don't feel like we need to all be in the same physical space in order to have great ideas, in order to collaborate. And I do think that while it's not going to stay this way forever, I do think a lot of what we've learned about the importance of collaboration without physical proximity is going to stick. And I think it's going to create some really interesting unintended consequences as we see brilliant people from everywhere able to come in and have a seat at the table.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, Ben, thank you so much. Thank you for the time. Really appreciate it. I thought it was completely fascinating, the presentation. And Promax community, thanks for tuning in and spending the afternoon with us. If you, once again, I say this at the end of every session, and I get some great ideas from you guys. So you do have a suggestion for a session, email connect@promax.org or reach out to me directly. And we'll see you guys next week. Thanks again. Thank you, Ben. And stay safe. We'll talk soon.
That's it for this episode of the Daily Brief Podcast. If you don't already, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for conversations, please feel free to reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org. And as always, thanks for listening.